Great. So tonight is Wednesday, September 1st, right, 2010, and I'm Rick Hansen. And last week, for those of you who are here, we focused on an aspect of what in Buddhism is called the feeling tone, or in Western psychology is called the hedonic tone, this quality of experience as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's really important to pay attention to in everyday life and also in terms of the aspiration for awakening, because it's on the heels of the feeling tone that the inner iguana and the inner monkey and the inner caveman or cavewoman, you know, starts to rumble and either chases after things that are pleasant or resists things that are unpleasant, and then progressively, typically tips into various forms of craving, clinging, and then suffering. So becoming more and more aware of the feeling tone and becoming more and more nimble in how we practice with that feeling tone is very, very useful. One of the fundamental practices, certainly in Buddhism and even as well in certain Western psychologies, is to develop greater equanimity, which is kind of like a shock absorber, in that the feeling tone is going to come and go probably for the rest of our life. There are things we can do gradually over time to increase the amount of pleasant sensations and emotions and so forth, and decrease the unpleasant ones, although there's no escape from of course, all forms of unpleasant feeling tone. We can do that generally over time, but you know, have you ever noticed that life happens? Things keep coming at us, stuff happens, including the habitual patterns of the mind that are not yet uprooted. Well, when those pleasant or unpleasant feeling tones occur, if we don't have any kind of a shock absorber, we're like little robots, programmed and reactive to those feeling tones. But if we have more of a shock absorber, the feeling tones arise, but we don't, which are in a sense reactions to various stimuli, external and internal. But once those reactions occur, we don't have to react to the reactions. That's equanimity. And that's a profound peace, and is getting very close to a fundamentally unconditional happiness. Because happiness then is increasingly not conditioned on having a pleasant feeling tone. In Buddhism, particularly Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about the eight worldly winds, right? Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, fame and ill repute. And then there's one more, praise and blame. There we go. Okay? Interesting that that half of them, 4 out of 8, have to do with relationships, which we'll be getting at more to a little later tonight. So the conventional life is one that depends on catching a good breeze for one's happiness, right? Pleasure rather than pain, gain rather than loss, fame rather than ill repute, praise rather than blame, right? Increasingly, though, with equanimity and the capacity to practice with the feeling tone with internal shock absorbers, one's happiness and capacity to be loving and kind and good to other people and create benefits in this world is not so dependent, ultimately completely independent, of catching a good breeze, which way the wind blows. All right? That's good stuff. So last week we talked about the subtlety, really, of how this works a lot in the brain and the mind in terms of anticipation. Much of the time, we run little mini-movies in the simulator inside the brain and the mind in which we imagine certain things. What will happen if I do this? What will happen if I say that? What will happen if I speak from my heart? What will happen if I stick my neck out at work? What will happen if that person gets mad at me? What will I feel inside if this thing I'm worried about occurs, right? And then, very quickly, we react to what we anticipate, the anticipated pleasure or the anticipated pain, and then the whole cascade begins. In effect, we become kind of intoxicated, right? We lose our minds a little bit to this anticipated pleasure or pain, which, interestingly, is rarely as good or as bad as promised. If you look closely at the little mini-movies, these little scenarios, these little conversations, these little anticipated experiences, the pleasure they promise, like, oh, okay, I'm going to do that. I'm going to eat that food. I'm going to go shopping for that. I'm going to have that experience with that person. I'm finally going to get loved, whatever it is, okay? And then when we actually measure what occurs compared to the promised pleasure, isn't it interesting? It's rarely so good, it's rarely so intense, and it's never as lasting, right? And that, I think, is because, honestly, the circuitry in the brain that does this is in the limbic system, which is really ancient. You know, it's sort of the early mammal brain. We're talking about 100 million years old, 80 million years old. So the pleasures or the pains it throws up to the mind tend to be fairly primitive. You can see this in your own experience. But in reality, with the more complex brain we have and the complex lives we have, the pleasures and pains are also more complex and subtle. So much of the time we're actually deceived. We're deceived by this internal anticipator machine, right? Which is tricking us routinely that this will be wonderful or that will be awful. And the truth is, it's usually a lot more complicated than that. So that's what we talked a lot about last time, the intoxication of anticipation. And in particular, looking at the tendency to be engaged in the future. And the fact that the way out of this intoxication of anticipation is the sobriety of now. It's being in the now and experiencing, ultimately, in the nature of being now, that being now, when we actually look closely at it and we're not trying to get out of now and the beingness of now, is really, really deeply peaceful. We're not intoxicated when we're in the now. We're not caught up in anticipation. And in fact, even if there is unpleasantness now, deeper than that unpleasantness in the nature of mind at the emergent edge of now, right? Just as now is appearing, the nature of beingness, the nature of mind at that emergent edge, I think is truly Buddha nature. I think that is what is meant by Buddha nature. And that emergent edge has a quality to it of freedom because it hasn't yet congealed into what it actually will become. So living at that emergent edge in a kind of freedom wholeheartedly has a great deal of natural, innate, unconditional well-being. So that's what we talked about last time. Somehow, sitting outside with no campfire, we ended up, you know, in the deep end of the pool. So, okay, so far as a recap, especially for those of you that were there. So for tonight, what I'd like to do is to keep moving and look at, as I said in the email I sent out, I think on Monday morning or something, look at wholesome aspirations. In other words, pleasant experiences are not all bad. You know, the middle way in Buddhism is not an ascetic rejection of pleasant experience per se. It's based on an insightful analysis of what happens in the mind when pleasant arises, right? As well as a distinction between what in Pali is called tanha, which is craving, the root of which is thirst, and in Pali being the language of the earliest surviving written record of the Buddha's teachings, chanda, which is wholesome desire. The wish that one's friends be well, the wish that beings be truly happy, you know, the wish that others here this evening be safe and healthy and live with ease. That's chanda. That's perfectly all right. You know? The pleasure one takes in, you know, a beautiful day or the laughter of a child or the sunlight on the water that fills one's heart and is chanda. The pleasure one experiences in being skillful. For example, in deliberately opening up to these positive experiences that fill the heart so that we take them in, we take in the good and gradually build up resources and implicit memory, you know, emotional memory, so that we feel inside ourselves increasingly that our own cup is full, So we're less focused on reaching out and grasping here and there, you know, to get the best milkshake in the world, right? The more that we, you know, taking pleasure in that skill is also chanda. So I want to explore with you tonight what some of your own good chandas are, all right? And interestingly, it's a lot easier to practice with tanha. It's a lot easier to practice with craving, with the inner iguana, you know, the inner reflexes that chase pleasure and you know, hate pain. It's easier to practice with those when we feel already full in the heart. Okay? So I'd like to just be quiet for a moment or so, a moment or two, and have you identify for yourself and ask, you know, a wholesome desire. I'll use the word aspiration fairly often with regard to that. What is that wholesome desire? What is that wholesome aspiration that's real for you these days? Maybe it could be an area of frustration, frankly, where if you were to look at yourself a little bit from a bird's eye view and have compassion for yourself, if you know, if you were a good friend to yourself, what would you wish for yourself? You know, what would you wish that you had more of for real in your life? Or what would you wish that your dear friend, you, had more confidence in pursuing? Or maybe more discipline in manifesting or engaging? Oh, hang on just a bit. We'll be quiet, but then, no, you're really great. We'll ask you just a bit. That's great. So for a moment, just think, what would it be for you? Okay, maybe we could hear some examples of wholesome aspiration. What's yours?
I apologize.
Yeah.
Well, I was just reading something that the Dalai Lama had written, and that he thought that people need affection, that was something that, and I thought, I was amazed by that. It was just the notion of how much affection.
Yeah, would that be an aspiration for yourself?
Absolutely.
That to have, yeah, it's a wholesome desire for affection. Okay, good. How about other people? Wholesome desires that have real traction for you, real weight, yeah.
I think this is a wholesome desire. Two of them, I would like to be able to feel the feelings and not try to escape from them.
Mm.
And if you really feel them, then they change and shift so they're not harmful. I'm not sure if that's a wholesome desire. But,
yep.
And
yes.
Then to not be afraid of the power of my words. And when using right speech, I mean assuming it's right speech, not be afraid of the weight they carry.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, great. Good. All right.
Kindness towards myself and to others.
Yeah.
That's basically
it. That's great. There are other hands. Yeah, right there.
Well, one just ties in with what all these people said, and that is just to feel loved, which is similar to affection, but a feeling of just being loved from nowhere in particular, or no one in particular, but just a sense of that feeling.
Thank you. Thank you. Great.
Being of service.
Great. It's very wholesome. It goes to, go on.
I struggle a little with it. I like to do it. I love the feeling. But I wrestle with sometimes being in the moment and the joy of doing it as opposed to sort of patting myself on the back or being recognized for it.
Yeah. That's a great distinction, and I'll comment right now if I could briefly about that. It's something I've grappled with myself, you know. The Buddha, he said it's helpful to appreciate yourself when you're doing something good, you know, with an act of, you know, word, thought, or deed. It's helpful. It's motivating. It's rewarding. You know, I think it's funny that when our heart is open and our body is soft, and we observe ourselves, you know, doing something good, you know, or manifesting a wholesome intention, and we have a kind of recognition of that. In my experience, there's a softness and a sweetness in that recognition that doesn't engender. I think of it as like the inner centipede scrabbling after this little inner beetle that wants more. Right? It doesn't feel that way, does it? It has more of this kind of soft, sweet sense of benevolent, you know. Yeah, good on you. Good one. So, I think that's perfectly useful. Yeah.
More fun.
Fun, wholesome aspiration? Yeah, totally. You know, we're the animal that laughs, right? So more fun, great. Maybe a couple others, any other? Yeah, great.
There were so many words used that apply. I don't know if it's equanimity or confidence or trust, but I'm having some changes happen around me, so I'm trying to be in charge of my own piece of it, and having to make some scary decisions, and I'm trying to just stay on the side of the street where I can just trust myself.
Yeah.
To make what's wise and appropriate for me.
Great. Good, thank you. Yeah. Maybe two more. Yeah. Well,
I think self-accountability
is a wholesome aspiration, being accountable to yourself. Mm-hmm. You mean in a
yeah.
in a good moral sense, mm-hmm. not full of self, you know, punishment or guilt tripping, but
right. being to be accountable for your own self and actions and
yeah.
thoughts and desires.
Great. Yeah, definitely. Thank you. I thought I saw one more hand.
And this, be able to paint.
That, yeah, creative expression is a big one. Creative expression is a really big one. Great. 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 Okay. So I want to offer a quote from the Buddha, or our best guess from the Buddha, about this, and then make a point about the fruit in the path, and then do a little practice with you. So, in the Dhammapada, it says, "If by renouncing a lesser happiness, one may realize a greater happiness, let the wise one renounce the lesser, having regard for the greater." That's it right there, isn't it? It's wisdom in a nutshell is giving up a lesser good for a greater one. The things we cling to, why do we cling to them? Why do we cling to them? We cling to them for good reasons, we think, right? Whatever it is, you know, we cling to being right and prevailing in some argument with somebody, or we cling to our inhibitions about living larger, living more fully, often unconscious inhibitions. We cling to them, or, you know, we cling to our possessions, or we cling to the things we identify with for good reasons. We think they'll do good for us and others. They'll do good things. Deep down, all intentions are positive. They may be pursued in really problematic ways, but the intentions themselves are positive. So we're always in a process, in effect, of giving up a lesser good for a greater one. Right? So it's really worth asking, you know, as you kind of are faced with choices in the day, high road, low road, right? Left or right? Which path is toward the lesser good and which path is toward the greater good? And how can I help myself increasingly and increasingly reliably tip toward the greater good? Right. So one of the ways to do that, so is that clear so far?
You said the quote again?
Yeah. The Buddha says, if by renouncing a lesser happiness, one may realize a greater happiness, let the wise one renounce the lesser, having regard for the greater. There's a story in Hinduism of Krishna and the gopis. You know, some of you may know the story already, and I don't promise to tell it perfectly well. But Krishna, imagine Krishna as an embodiment, if you will, of the divine, or if you prefer not to think in that way, you can imagine Krishna as simply an embodiment of wonderful human qualities. Just wonderful qualities. And the gopis were cowherds, women in ancient India who were tending to the cattle. And they saw Krishna on the bank, as it were, or nearby, but at a bit of a distance. And in effect, each one of them saw Krishna, or an aspect of Krishna, that touched her own heart the most, which itself is a neat little bit of teaching, that, you know, that the apprehension of the divine is individualized. That's a fancy way of putting it, right? But that it's okay for us to be drawn to those particular qualities that really speak to our own heart and to allow other people to be drawn to other things as long as they're another emanation of Krishna, as it were. And then the point that I'm getting at here in the story is that Krishna did not deliver a Tony Robbins seminar, you know? He did not give a big pitch about why they ought to just dump those cattle and, you know, give up the lesser mundane life and pursue the spiritual one. They just simply were so attracted to him, so drawn to what they felt was possible there, the possibility, what, and so forth, that they just left the cattle behind. And they went over there. And it's the principle of attraction. Right, we can, as we help ourselves on the path of life and the path of awakening, we can resist the negative, we can resist the lesser pleasures, or we can increasingly incline ourselves toward the greater ones, the greater goods.
Rick, can you give an example of a lesser pleasure?
Sure. So there I am, the end of the day, and I'm tired, I've worked hard. Lesser pleasures include I could write some emails, I could relax, I could sit outside, I could read a book, I could just sort of space out, or I could put on my shorts and go jog up in the hills above my house. After every single time of which, I'm glad I chose that one than over the other one. The real definition of a greater pleasure is after you make that choice, then looking back, are you glad you did it or regret? Would you say to yourself, yeah, it turned out better that I did this? It was a better dinner party when I stopped at two glasses of wine or whatever, you know? Or that interaction with my spouse or partner went better when I didn't raise my voice. Or I felt a lot better at the end of the night with the kids when I didn't go into that, you know, scolding parent mode, right? You feel it. Mm-hmm. Or alternately, at the end of the interaction, you know, where you, let's say, you chose the pleasure of feeling safer and cautious and so forth, and as a result, you really didn't say what was in your own mind. Mm-hmm. You know, you didn't use your words fully. You didn't speak fully from your heart. You didn't have a sense of self-confidence or self-advocacy. At the end of that interaction, How do you feel? Are you glad you took that road rather than the other one? I mean, that often tells us, and usually we know deep down. Sometimes it's messier, but often it's fairly clear, right? And rather than, you know, get all twisty in the mind about the cases that are very ambiguous, why not focus on the ones where it's really pretty clear which the high road is and help oneself increasingly, you know, take the upper path. Right. So that goes to, I just think this principle of attraction is really important. It's great when raising kids. It's great when working with other people. You know, why should, oftentimes we deal with other people and we think, well, they should want X, but they keep choosing Y, darn it. Well, given their frame of reference, why in the world should they choose X? Like, why should they want X? What's in it for them? You know, and finding ways to attract the important people in our lives to X rather than Y, whatever it is, without being manipulative or taking excessive responsibility for that. But thinking in terms of the principle of attraction, you know, it's very useful. And very often what will most attract people to X is our own demonstration. I was talking with someone recently about something I just laugh about, that we take adolescents, for example, teenagers in this culture, that were very intertwined with the world of adulthood as we evolved until extremely recently, not just in hunter-gatherer periods up to the last 10,000 years, but even during most of the last 10,000 years, adolescents were very woven into adult life. So they got to experience a lot of adult guidance and values and so forth, and they got to see up close and personal what happens when people don't choose the greater good over the lesser one. You know, don't, for example, put up the hay in the summertime, you know, for the winter or something like that. So today what we do is we shove them in these enclaves, these reservations, you know, schools and malls, or virtual reservations, you know, with their earbuds and their screens and their IMs. Now they're on their own little world. And we say, okay, we want you to give up all these pleasures that your 15-year-old or 18-year-old body really wants, right, where the sap is really rising, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We want you to give up all of those pleasures, or most of them, really, so that you can work really hard learning stuff that we all know you will have forgotten most of by the end of the school year, so that you can have an adult life like mine. Right? And they look at us, and they go, are you kidding? You know, you come home, you don't like your job, you kick the dog, you quarrel with my dad, my mom, you don't seem very happy, you seem kind of lost. Are you kidding? I'm supposed to give up all these concrete and immediate pleasures for some vague and distant benefit that looks like you? You know what I mean? These cows look a lot better, right, than that beaten down middle-aged person over there with all those wrinkles and bills. Right? It reminds me of traditional teachers in Asia. You know, parents come to them and say, how do I get my kids to be interested in spiritual life? And they say, don't worry about the kids. You know, manifest spiritual life yourself. The kids will naturally be drawn in your direction. All right, so that's the principle of attraction. You know, one example of the principle of attraction. So to kind of move to the finish line here, think about the term that's used in Tibetan Buddhism, taking the fruit as the path. That's the idea that we use the goal of practice, the states of being, states of heart and mind and body and speech and deed and so forth. We take those as the path itself. In other words, by increasingly grounding ourselves in a sense of, a taste of, and a growing immersion in, a growing density of experiencing of the aims of practice, we both, you know, live the good life, as it were, in the deepest sense, here and now, and we also increasingly incline the mind in the direction we want it to go. For example, if to use a number of some of the aspirations that you were naming here, if a person wants to be loved, what we can do is bring the mind to the caring, the kindness, the good wishes, the love that's already present in one's life, and ground increasingly in feeling loved, which isn't it interesting, tends to draw more love in this direction. Right? Or someone said painting, or in my own case I could say more time in wilderness, or another person might say, you know, dancing, or whatever it is, or more fun. Someone said fun there in the back. We could hold that goal out there, and there's a place for going down the path. The Buddha talked a lot about path and direction and growth over time and development and training, and it's okay. It's okay to think in those terms. But on the other hand, that has a pitfall in it sometimes of, you know, endlessly deferring the good state. An alternative would be to say, okay, here and now, I'm going to experience what is it like to embody fun, or embody playfulness, or embody creativity, or carve out 1 minute a day for art, or 10 minutes a day, or 1 hour a day for art, or 1 hour a week, or 3 hours on Sunday for what I'm going to do, right? And instead of deferring it way out there, take the fruit as the path. So I want to do a little experience with you right now, and then we can talk about this, all right? Actually, but before I do that, I want to mention a particular fruit that wasn't mentioned, but I suspect it was in your mind, and that's the aspiration of awakening. You know, both, and I like that word awakening because I don't know if you know this little detail in Pali, the language of early, you know, Buddhism, there are essentially no nouns. Everything is a gerund. In other words, there is no dog, it's dogging. Everything is a process, right? Because everything's now, so it's all process. So awaken, awakening. I like that because it's ambiguous. It's the fruit and the path. We are in the process of awakening, and there is also here and now awakening, you know, being awake, right? Being wakeful, okay? So, you know, that wasn't really mentioned. I want to call it out to you, and I have a quote here with regard to that, including one of the aspects of awakening, which is contemplation. And they're going to use a word here, meditation, that I think means more than just simply, you know, sitting on the cushion for 10 minutes or, you know, 45 minutes every day. Wisdom springs from meditation. Without meditation, wisdom wanes. Having known these two paths of progress and decline, let one so conduct oneself that one's wisdom may increase. One of your aspirations, I'm sure, you know, is around awakening, wakefulness, enlightenment, you know, freedom from suffering, liberation. And that's also something where one can take the fruit as the path and feel into what is it like to actually embody those qualities of mind and heart right here and right now. Okay, so I just want to mention that one too. Okay, so if you could, as a little experiment, you don't have to do it, I suggest that you pick some aspiration for yourself, and you can do this, what we'll do now for a minute or two, with more than one probably. It could be awakening, it could be feeling loved, it could be affection, it could be anything that was named or not named here, okay? So pick it, and then, and let's kind of maybe either have our eyes closed or look down, move your body in a way and with a subtle shift to it or stance that feels closer to an embodiment of the realization of that aspiration. If the aspiration is to be loved, what's it like to feel loved? If the aspiration is toward affection, what's it like to feel affection? If the aspiration is toward having fun, what's it like to feel like fun? All right? If the aspiration is wakefulness, what's it like, you know, to feel awake, to be here and now, the fulfillment of this yearning of your heart? it's really normal if this quality of mind that you kind of settle into a bit crumbles, and then you find your way back to it again. That's really, really normal. And one thing you might explore, if you like, is to imagine bringing one or more beings into your mind who join with you in this aspiration, who wish the fulfillment of it for you, for real, who support you in this. These beings might be, you know, material, real beings you know. They could be spirit entities or imagined beings. They're on your side. For you fulfilling your heart's deep longings. See what that's like, to bring into your awareness beings that support you in fulfilling your aspirations. And last, if you like, grounded to the extent that you are in this felt sense of the fulfillment of your aspiration, imagine going forward from this place throughout the next week until we gather here again. Even with, along the way, a continuing sense of beings supporting you, cheering you on, encouraging you. Being with the truth of you over the next week in terms of this particular aspiration. If you'll forgive me, I think this is actually a good place to end tonight. It's a little past 8:30, and I think it's okay to not get into a lot of chatter about this. And I encourage you this week to really explore what it's like to give yourself over to your best self. You know, to give yourself over to the greater good. To give yourself over, you know, to the highest happiness. And may each ring of the gong here send you out into the world, you know, enjoying this and deepening in it. See you next week, I hope.